From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. One of the important historical and intellectual elements of military and political conflict in the Middle East is Zionism. On that topic, here is Werner Danhauser, a scholar at the National Humanities Center and political philosopher at Cornell University. Professor Danhauser recently wrote for the New York Times a review of a new book on the intellectual origins of the Jewish state. The book is The Making of Modern Zionism. Its author is Shlomo Avineri.
Modern Zionism, most simply put, is a movement for the establishment and the preservation of a Jewish state for the Jewish people.
Where did this originate? Is it as old as the Jews themselves?
Well, they did not have a longing for a state only in such a period as they had a state. So in a way, the longing begins with the dispersal of the Jews in the first century by the Romans. Now, we distinguish that longing throughout the centuries from modern Zionism, which has a practical dimension, which involves Jews actually going back to Israel in more massive groups on a public program to enlist the world in helping them, because the Jews, though a very famous or perhaps notorious people, have always been an incredibly small minority of mankind's population.
Is Zionism, as you have described it, spiritual or political?
Well, the breakthrough in the 19th century toward the end came when Zionism became a political movement. Now, to a certain extent, it had been a political movement to the Jews 30 to 40 years earlier, but Zionism became political Zionism with Theodor Herzl, who succeeded in placing it on the world's political agenda, and who created an organization, the Zionist Movement, through the World Zionist Congress, the first one, which met in Basel in 1897. So that is the political movement, but Zionists have always either implicitly or explicitly distinguished among various kinds of Zionism. Political Zionism simply wants a state. Cultural Zionism says, well, if we get a state and it becomes a kind of banana republic, what value would that be? It has to be a state of a certain content. Religious Zionism then says, yes, but that content must remain basically religious. That is, the culture is the culture of the Bible. But then there is an additional problem, that religious Zionism can only be part Zionism because it can only be part earthly. These three distinctions are made by Zionists themselves, and the problem is articulated that way by my teacher, Leo Strauss.
Werner, it sounds, from what you've been describing, as though people who are either hostile or indifferent to Zionism really shouldn't worry because it's fragmented. Is that the case?
No, it isn't. I would say Jews now overwhelmingly support the state of Israel. Not all of them, it's true, worked for it. And they worked, those who did, in various degrees of activity or passivity. But today, when there is a state of Israel, most Jews, the overwhelming majority of them, believe that the existence of the Jewish state is a great blessing to them and indirectly to all mankind.
So it's fair to say that simply to support the existence of Israel is, in a sense, to be a Zionist.
Yes, but there are more or less passionate Zionists, more or less committed Zionists, and more or less aware Zionists, or more or less critical Zionists, so they come in many varieties.
Werner, what does this word Zionism mean? How did that originate?
Zion is another word, originally, I believe, for Jerusalem and its environs, and it's a word that is taken from the Bible. It occurs frequently in the Psalms.
So Zion can be a state of the heart, can it? Why does it have to be territory in the Middle East?
Yes, indeed, but that's been the lot of the Jews since they lost their state And in order to have a heart to pursue your analogy, you need a body to carry it. Zionism is the physical assurance that there will be Jews to pursue their spiritual endeavors.
Werner, you mentioned the heart and the body. Let's talk about the mind. The book that you have reviewed is The Making of Modern Zionism, and the subtitle reads The Intellectual Origins of the Jewish State. Now, presumably that is a modern phenomenon, is it not?
Yes. The yearning for the Jewish state began with the dissolution of the Jewish state in the first century or so by the Romans. But the, let's say, transfiguration or transformation of that inchoate yearning into a political movement with plans, strategies, and what would today be called ideologies, I prefer to call it a body of thought. That is a phenomenon of the 19th century, basically.
And where did this originate? You mentioned Theodor Herzl.
Theodor Herzl marks the breakthrough of Zionism to the world stage. But Mr. Avineri has done a very good job of cataloging a lot of figures that existed before Theodor Herzl. You might say the Zionist problem began to emerge when Europe became conscious of nationalism, and here was this people, for the Jews could never fit into the category of just a religion, here was this people without a land. So the inevitable thought came that these people deserve a land, and this thought was propelled or fueled by the fact that the 19th century, according to Avineri, and I think he's right, was rather good to the Jews. They were, by and large, more or less, it varied from place to place, emancipated, that is, admitted into the mainstream of life, of European life. And they performed very well indeed, but it did not solve their problems.
And the success that you're describing crystallized in the desire for not only a spiritual, but a geographical locus.
Yes. But Judaism is a geographical religion. All one has to do is to read the Bible. The longings are for both an earthly and a spiritual Jerusalem. But many of the prayers that we Jews pray today have to do still with the land and the rain and the fruits and the seasons. And Jerusalem, the holy city, the faithful city, as the Bible calls it.
What are the main intellectual concerns of Zionism? To paraphrase that subtitle of Avineri's book.
Well, in the 19th century, the most obvious concern was, how do we get a homeland? Then there was a controversy. Would that homeland have to be Palestine, or could it be any place? At various times, Argentina was considered, and Uganda for a short time was actually offered by the British to the Jews. Then there was the concern, what kind of a country do we want? What is the Jewish imperative? What will fulfill our needs? And yet another question arose very soon. It became obvious that not all Jews would or even could go to Israel, or to Palestine, as it was then called. So an important concern of Zionism has always been, what is the relation between what we call Israel and the diaspora?
And what does that term mean?
The diaspora meant originally the exile. But in traditional Jewish thought, and that's one of the problems with which Zionism has to cope, exile is both spiritual and territorial. So the Jewish problem, the Zionists soon realized, would not be terminated by their return to a state.
Werner, I wonder if you could describe some of the bringing together, the comings together of people and events and ideas in the 19th century and in the 20th that account for the development of Zionism.
All right. Let me begin with what I've already mentioned, that in the wake of Napoleon, and this was one of the reasons he's considered a benefactor to us Jews, the Jews were more or less emancipated. So the first events are early in the 19th century, as the Jews get their freedom and realize that it doesn't dispose of anti-Semitism, that emancipation carries a secret price with it. ultimately the disappearance of Jews. The Jews should become like all other people, which means they should stop being Jews. Then, and this is why Moses Hess is an early Zionist and one of the great heroes, there is the intermeshing of growing nationalism and growing socialism in the 19th century, that the movement stemmed intellectually from Hegel, who took the form of Marx, and one of the earliest Zionists, Hess, was a sometime friend of Marx. So the question was, what kind of a liberation should the Jews have? And in a way, Mr. Avineri is perfectly correct in saying that Zionism is the national liberation movement of the Jewish people. Now, as you go on into the 19th century, what happens is that there's a kind of bifurcation between Russian Zionism and German Zionism. In Russia, the situation steadily deteriorates, and the people in Russia, especially following pogroms and massacres in 1881 and 1905, they need an actual place to go to. As it happened, most of them came to America, but a sizable number came to Palestine. So there is Russian Zionism, which is socialist and much more practically oriented. At the same time, the problems of the German Jews are much more ineffable somehow. It's their being ill at ease in the very countries which they have admitted to them. It's that they face a more gentle, but ultimately a more lethal anti-Semitism. And that is where then Herzl comes in. And with Herzl, one might say Zionism began to be German in its domination, in its intellectual domination, while the Russians provided the majority of the people that actually settled in what was to become Israel.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation with Werner Danhauser, a scholar at the center and political philosopher at Cornell University. Professor Danhauser is discussing a recent book on the intellectual origins of the Jewish state, entitled The Making of Modern Zionism by Shlomo Avineri. Professor Danhauser recently reviewed Avineri's book for the New York Times. How did these strands that you've been describing, these historical and cultural strands, come together in the 20th century? Is it overly simplifying it to say that in 1948 the state of Israel was founded, that is what it was all leading to?
That's what it was all leading to, but there was a major political event, not only for the Jews, of course, but for the world, World War I. During that time, the Zionist movement was split, but I don't think we'd better get into that, because Jews have always been split in all ways. There is a saying among Jews that where there are two Jews, you'll find three political opinions. So, but what happened in 1917 is that the British issued a proclamation called the Balfour Declaration, which said that His Majesty's government viewed with favor the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. And at that time, the world, for the first time, as it were, gave sanction to the Zionist project. At that time, too, or very shortly thereafter, Arab opposition began. So you had now two national movements, one very slowly developing, the Arab one, and that led to a proposition in 1947, a declaration by the United Nations. The British had given the Palestine problem over to the United Nations because they didn't know how to solve it. The United Nations proposed partition of what was then Palestine. The Jews accepted partition. The Arabs didn't. The state was founded in 1948. Five Arab armies immediately marched on it, and the Jews won the war and established Israel.
One line that appears in Mr. Avineri's book on the intellectual origins of Zionism is his notion that Zionism is what he calls the most fundamental revolution in Jewish life. What's he getting at there?
Well, Jewish life, with the dispersal of the Jews or the elimination of a state by the Romans, had become very passive. And Jews were the object of history, as Hegel, one of the ancestors of the 19th century, might say, rather than the subject. They weren't actors anymore. What happened, and what was Zionism's great glory and great achievement, was to make the Jews take their destiny much more into their own hands than had ever been done before, to say, no, we're not going to be at the mercy of other people and at their whims. We are going to get a state back so that we can determine our own fate and destiny as a group.
Werner, we're talking about Shlomo Avineri's book on the intellectual origins of Zionism and the making of modern Zionism. Why is it that, in your review, you say that this is the book for people who have honest doubts about Zionism?
Well, in a way, it's the book because the history of Zionism must be written anew every few years because the questions change. The fundamental issues don't change, but their aspects, the various perspectives of men change. And today, if I weren't a Jew, I would certainly have my problems with Zionism. I would say, why should so small a number of people, so little of people, engage so much time, so much energy of mankind? Why are the Jews so stubborn? Why don't they say yes to whatever Washington says? What about the Arabs? Aren't they in their camps in a pitiful situation? And I think those are all legitimate questions. And I think, in a way, the Jews have always gotten it from both the right and the left. But today, the nature of those questions change, and it's the great achievement of Mr. Avineri's book that he doesn't try to duck those questions, but faces them very squarely.
And how does he answer them?
To the right, he says that the Jews are not left-wingers, and they may be left, but they are very honorably left. You see, Israel, by the right, has always been considered a socialist state, and that's in a way true. But he shows very conclusively that this wasn't an abstract doctrinaire ideology. It was a response to the specific situation of the Jews, to the needs to colonize a land and to have a kind of frontier effort in the 20th century, and that it doesn't owe everything to Marx, and least to the most dogmatic assertions of Marx. For example, there was never a problem of a Zionist avant-garde party dictatorially controlling everything. It owes quite as much to utopian socialism, and even to Tolstoy with his rather mystical version of the dignity of labor. Now, on the left, Zionists are perpetually compared to racists, to imperialists, and so forth, and he shows that actually Zionism is, as I've said, and even as Gromyko said at one point in history, the national liberation movement of the Jewish people. It simply means that the Jews want a home like every other people. That's not all it means, but that's a vital part of it. And the tragedy is that there are two nationalisms. And Zionism wasn't cruel or obtuse to Arab needs. On an individual basis, there was always concern that Arabs enjoy full rights as citizenship, for example, even as they do in Israel today. The problem was that when Zionism began to blossom, there was not yet Arab nationalism in general, and there certainly wasn't Palestinian nationalism. Well into the 20th century, to Arabs, Palestine was simply Lower Syria. And Avineri points out these things. That doesn't mean that we think that Arabs who live in Israel today, especially as Israel has come to be known since the 67 war, lead a very enviable life, and that we mustn't care for them, and that something has to be done for them. But it means that before the bar of reason, before the bar of justice, and before the bar of history, Zionists really don't have to be apologetic. It's a very honorable and a very noble movement. And it's not imperialist. There are 3 to 4 million Jews in surrounded by 100 million or more Arabs. And it isn't a racist movement. It's a movement that acknowledges the Jews are a group and have certain rights and certain dignities.
Werner, how is it that you can find a way coherently through the detractors and the adherents to what you call the tangled truth of Zionism? How do you do that as you look at history? And is it possible to divorce yourself from the fact of being a Jew or not being a Jew as you look at something like Zionism?
It's not possible for me personally, because Zionism is like mother's milk to me, and I've never attempted to disassociate myself from my Judaism or my Zionism. But I would say that political engagement, or for that matter, any other kind of engagement, can as much be a way to the truth as lack of engagement, so long as one tries to be honest and acknowledge that there are differences. Now, there are differences, and of course there's opposition to Zionism. Zionism is a political movement, and every human political movement encounters opposition, even encounters self-doubt. I'd say that's the name of the game in politics, and one mustn't expect clear answers and the clear one-sided truths. I would be the last to deny, and I don't think any thinking Zionist has ever denied, that the Arabs have a case. The case was, I think, best described with a man with whom Mr. Avineri doesn't agree, Vladimir Jabotinsky, but of whom he gives a very sympathetic portrayal. Vladimir Jabotinsky is a revisionist Zionist. You can very crudely call him an extreme right-wing Zionist. Jabotinsky, testifying before a League of Nations Board of Inquiry, said, of course the Arabs have a case. The Arabs have a case and we have a case. The difference is that one is the case of a hungry people and one is the case of a starving people. That Jewish life really could not be very conceivable, in my opinion, without a state, especially after the Holocaust. And there are doubts among Jews, too. They are today very much in favor of Israel, but we should realize that a majority of them never chose to go to Israel, and a majority of them doesn't intend to go now. Some people didn't want the establishment of a Jewish state because they wanted to assimilate. They wanted to stop being Jews. That's an option I can understand. If the truth be told, on the deepest level, I can't really respect it very much, or as much as I'm supposed to, but I think I can understand it. Then there are Jews who are so religious that they are not Zionist. That's another peculiar case. They say that Zionism is a movement for a return to the Holy Land, and that's all very well, but it must be done by the Messiah. And there has been in Jewish thought all the time an idea that one must not hasten the coming of the Messiah. But to me, and well, what's more important to a good number of religious Jews, Zionism is not hastening the coming of the Messiah. It may be taking a small step for the preparation when God, in his mercy, will solve the Jewish problem, even as he'll solve mankind's problems.
And what is that solution? Is it possible to summarize it?
I think it has been summarized better than I could in the Bible, when nations shall beat their swords into plowshares and the word of the Lord shall go forth from Jerusalem, when the lion shall lie down next to the lamb, when people will live much more nobly, more beautifully and productively than they do. But in the meantime, well, the Psalms teach us that some put their faith in chariot and horses, but we call on the name of the Lord. We have learned that we also need chariots and horses in the meantime.
Werner Danhauser is a scholar at the National Humanities Center who teaches political philosophy at Cornell University. Danhauser has written widely on politics and philosophy. He served as an associate editor at Commentary magazine. At the National Humanities Center, Professor Danhauser is writing a book about the influences, contributions, and limitations of Marx and Marxism in 20th century philosophy and politics. From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The worst solitude, said Francis Bacon, is to be destitute of sincere friendship. But what's the nature of friendship itself? Here's a comment from William Bennett, the director of the National Humanities Center.
Everybody has friends, but have we forgotten what they're really for? I've talked to a lot of people about this, and I don't think anybody had it quite in the crosshairs like Aristotle. He knew what he was talking about when he spoke about friendship. Aristotle said there are three kinds of friendship. First, he said, one has friends for utility. You help me and I'll be your friend. There's nothing wrong with this kind of friendship. It's the kind that often exists between neighbors who send rakes and hoes and picnic coolers back and forth across the fence. This is a friendship of utility. Now, a second kind of friendship, according to Aristotle, is friendship for pleasure. It can be added to the first kind, utility. And this happens if you think your neighbor's funny as well as useful. Or friendship of pleasure can stand on its own. It's friendship based on the pleasure the friend brings to you. Again, there's nothing wrong with it in Aristotle's view. It's perfectly appropriate that human beings will seek out those who give them pleasure. But, Aristotle says, friendships based on pleasure or usefulness can be easily dissolved. If your friend no longer makes you feel good, or you end up buying all the things which have made him useful to you for the borrowing, the basis of the friendship can vanish. He pointed out that young people are particularly prone to these kinds of friendships, falling in and out of friendship like they fall in and out of love. But the kind of friendship we don't hear a lot about these days is the third kind. To Aristotle, it was the noblest kind of friendship. Perfect friendship, Aristotle said, is the friendship of people who are good and who wish well to their friends, not for their own sake, but for their friend's sake. Such friendships, he says, will include pleasure and utility, for true friends will be pleasurable and useful to each other. But there's more. The friendship will last, Aristotle says, because it is based on the good character of the friends. And, he says in a splendid and concise little phrase, it will last because goodness is an enduring thing. Now, we don't hear much about that these days, because in some quarters, some people are embarrassed about that word good, unless it applies to restaurants or to the weather. In our time, people are a little afraid of the word good as it applies to character. But I think Aristotle had it just right. Some people we seek out not because they make us laugh or can put things in our pocket or help us along, but some we seek out only and solely, but it is a very great deal, because their presence persuades us that they are worthy to be with. Such friendship honors the friend, and in doing so, does honor to oneself as well.
William Bennett is director of the National Humanities Center.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina 27709. Director of the Center is William Bennett. Soundings is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond inviting you to join me this week for Soundings. One of the scholars at the center will review a new book on the historical and intellectual underpinnings of modern Zionism as it affects the cultural and political climates of the Middle East. Also this week, a commentary on three kinds of friendship. Please join me this week for Soundings.